We'd like to welcome everybody tonight. So thanks for joining us with Karen's teleseminar. And I'm your host, Melinda Garish. And my husband and I own Cutting Up Stables here in Shirley, Indiana, which is an overnight stay. And Karen, you're joining us from where at tonight?
I'm in Grand Junction, Colorado.
Colorado, okay. So it's 90 here, so I don't know what it is up there.
Or a little more than that, yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. So, well, listen, we've got several topics, and tonight we're going to talk about a hyper-alert horse that's on the trails and developing leadership, riding from above, staying in gait, and kind of last minute, Karen, we've added a red ribbon and what it means on the trail. And so we'll cover that one as well tonight. So we'll go ahead and get started. This one we're picking up from last month. We didn't get a chance to get to it. And this is Donna's question. And Donna has a 9-year-old Tennessee Walker, and she has owned him for 3 years. This year he has become hyper alert when riding him. His neck is arched, and he can feel his back tense, ears straight forward, looking at everything with fear. And it says, when I'm riding, I've tried keeping his feet busy, gating him, cutting off the trail, going up and over logs and around trees, circling back, squeezing him on when he gets too focused on an object. He even spooked with me last week when he came upon a tarp hanging from a tree. I was able to get his feet stop and chose to get off. I worked with him there with the object with me on the ground, forward, backward, circling over a log and with lots of change of direction. He never really came down to mentally being back with me. We worked a long time. I did feel confident enough to get back on him, and I gated him down the trail before ending the day. I have worked with him every day in the arena this week with extreme friendly games, plastic bags on a stick, tarps, jumping barrels, and he's fine, and he's relaxed as long as I'm on the ground. Now, somewhere the groundwork doesn't seem to help him on or translate to when I'm riding him. I thought maybe I had some tension that he was feeling when riding, so I had taken my iPod to listen to music while we rode to keep me from getting too far into my head. It worked for me, but I felt perfectly relaxed when we rode the other day, and he spooked. Yesterday, I took him out with another horse on a small trail, and when we were in front, he was worried and hyper-alert. When the other horse took the lead, he was relaxed and fine. We went up to the place he had spooked the day before. I walked him up to the tarp with me on the ground, and he could have cared less. And then here we go to the question, how do I keep him mentally with me when riding?
Well, as I listen to questions all the time, I feel like a detective. I'm looking for clues. One of the big clues right there is that when the other horse is leading, he's fine. So for some reason, your horse is not viewing you in that position of leadership. And this is where, when people come to hands-on clinics, people are doing really good things. They're practicing things on the ground. They're riding in the arena. They're going through all these kinds of things. But what we're really ultimately developing is not just a response from the horse, but a mental connection from the horse. And that's another stage that you'll move into. Because remember, our goal is to be able to go anywhere, anytime, do anything, and have fun doing it. Now, my horse is hyper alert to things on the trail, too. If you put him out in the wild, I guarantee you, you'd see him next year. So he's not going to get eaten by anything because he is aware and perceptive to those kinds of things. So our goal is to ultimately change this perceptiveness to danger to perceptiveness to communication. And it's not always being relaxed that the horse is looking for. So oftentimes what I'm trying to find the words to phrase this effectively for you. And one of the terms that Mr. Pirelli calls playing the seven games, and this was something that he would say, playing the seven games and winning the seven games are two different things. So what your horse is giving you feedback on is that going through your routine on the ground isn't necessarily that challenging for him anymore. And another stage you want to move into is being positive, progressive, and natural. And this is one of the things that I want to put out there for everyone to consider is that our horsemanship, developing our horsemanship, is a lifetime activity. This is not something that you get to a point and you go, oh, good, I'm done. You know, here we go off down the trail. And this is, you know, I get, you know, concerned sometimes because I'm not sure I'm clear in communicating that to people effectively enough, because people come to a few clinics and then they kind of go, okay, well, you know, it's starting to sound, you know, routine to me. And so, you know, I must have it. I've been to, you know, 3 or 4 clinics and now I've got it. And there's a young gal here in Grand Junction, Stephanie, who's turning 16 here next month. And I'll tell you what, she's been to 8 clinics. She came up to a clinic last weekend in Snowmass, Colorado. And I asked her, I said, you know, in front of everybody and most of the people there, it was their first clinic. And I said to Stephanie, I go, have you learned something new? And she goes, oh yeah. And that was on the first day. See, you can't take everything in just because you're, you know, at an event or you watch a video one time, that kind of thing. That's not the process of learning. So in answer to your question is that your horse is inviting you to dig deeper. It's inviting you to ask more of him. It's inviting you to expect more from him. So that when you're in those situations, not if, but when you're in those situations, and we all are in those situations, we find ourselves in those, under those conditions, under the unknown conditions with our horses, is that we automatically respond appropriately. And appropriate with a fear behavior is not necessarily backing off the pressure. And the reason I emphasize this, and I'm not sure that this is what's going on with your horse, Donna, but the reason I emphasize this is that it's a very common thing when the horse becomes scared, we have a tendency to stop, or a tendency to take them to this. I talked about this in the clinic this last weekend. We have a tendency, you know, we'll see the spooky thing first, you know, and then the horse goes, oh my gosh, it even scared the human, and they're higher on the food chain. And then we have a pattern to go over there and have the horse put its nose on it or sniff it or, you know, do all those kinds of things. The true leader in a herd, if you go back to our example of the leader in the herd environment, that horse is usually an older mare. She's been there, done that, bought the T-shirt. She sees something, and she goes along, and she walks by it and says, man, this doesn't bother me, okay? Because she's seen that. She's been there. She's done that. It hasn't harmed her. So she walks by things or through things, goes through water, goes by big scary rocks. She's walking around, you know, on windy days, you know, fill in the blank. And she's going through knowing that this is not what's the danger or threat to them, because she has that experience. So she doesn't stop and go, oh, the younger horses are scared. Let's wait and let them sniff it and investigate it. She just keeps on going, and then the other horses pick up on her confidence and direction and follow her. So I know you're on the back of the horse, and it's really amazing because horses will have trouble when we're on their back, and then we'll step down and lead them, and they're perfectly fine. So what that indicates to us is that our communication up on the back is not necessarily one from a position of leadership. So I'll give you an example. When I'm going along with my horse and my horse sees something, it could be, you know, a painted line on the road, or it could be, you know, a bit of water, or it could be something flapping on the side or overhead, or a car coming by or a car coming up from behind. I'm aware that those things are there. But all I know is that my focus is where we're going. And then if the horse moves over, say if I come up and something's on his left, and I focus, I'm looking at where we're going. I'm aware that something, you know, whatever it is on the left. And if he moves away from it, he's going to run into the pressure from my right leg and my right rein, and I'd be tipping his nose with my left rein. So if he walked on a straight line, that's where his comfort would be at the speed that I choose. If he hesitates, automatically my seat activates the transition upward communication. If he walks backwards, I'm ready to spank him to go forward. Okay. If he speeds up, I slow him down. So these are the forms of communication that we use, you know, when we're practicing all these things on the ground. But what we're really practicing is that when we're on the horse's back, we automatically communicate the response to that. So my focus is I'm going over here. I'm aware that that's over there, but all I know is that your feet are moving out of position of where I have in mind. When we don't use our natural power of focus, it's very, we get late. You know, the horse moves away from it, and in our mind we go, oh, you know, he's scared, and so he has to drift. Well, to me, he fell off a cliff. You know, that's the emphasis and the importance that I put on, you know, where my horse's feet are. So I guess that's what I'm inviting you to do, is because it sounds like you've been practicing, you know, ground skills, you've been practicing different things. And when you get onto the horse's back, what's missing is, you know, probably a higher level of expectation. I get people at clinics all the time that have been, you know, doing this form of communication with their horses. There's always another place to go. And that's what I really want to invite you to do, because and the number one thing that I find with people, and I talk about it every single weekend, is there's a lack of feel in our steady pressure. There's a lack of feel in our rein. There's a lack of feel with our leg. We tend to think, because we're taking a kinder, gentler approach with horses, that somehow touching the horse, making physical contact and having that horse run into, you know, our leg or run into pressure, you know, is somehow cruel. And oftentimes that's where horsemanship for women is really targeted, because as women we perceive physical contact as violence. And I'm not saying hit the horse or anything like that. I'm just saying when the horse drifts, say in my example, something scary on the left and the horse drifts to the right, oftentimes our leg isn't doing a thing. We just go into hanging on mode, okay? And the horse's head comes up. There's no response to it. And the horse says, oh, my gosh, I'm drifting further away, and there's no response on our end. So they tend to realize that they're the one in the lead position. There's nobody directing them, and that's where they get spooky on the trail. So it's kind of a long answer for what's, you know, kind of seeming like a short question, but if you can keep going back to those principles, those concepts, that philosophy, and start putting a real feel on your lead line when you're on the ground, a real feel on your rein when you're riding the horse, a real feel when that horse moves, you know, and tries to, and without a response from your leg, it has no direction. There's no direction. One of my teachers, Ronnie Willis, rode by me one time, and my horse was having trouble doing the exercise, and we're going through, and we had a real precision pattern to follow, and my horse was all over the place. And I kept thinking, what is wrong with this horse? And he rode by me and threw out what I call cowboy riddles, and Mr. Willis has passed away now, but I just treasure these little gems. At the time, I had no clue what he was talking about, but he'd ride by, and he'd say, you know, Karen, he'd say, who's driving that tugboat? And then he'd ride away, and I go, I don't know what you're talking about. So this answer is really encapsulated in Mr. Willis's comment to me, who's driving this tugboat? And in absence of leadership of our feel and our timing and our balance and our release of that pressure, you know, and I used to hold in my mind, even when you're scared, look to me for leadership, but I've changed that in recent years, especially when you're scared. Look to me for leadership. So when a horse becomes afraid, it's not the time to back off our pressure, because the release of pressure reinforces a behavior. So we can actually be inadvertently reinforcing a fear behavior. I've seen it many, many times. So when I help that horse, and I help that horse with my feel and my timing and my release, and I'm saying, hey, don't drift over here. There's an imaginary cliff in my mind. And it's as real as it can be, because someday it might be a cliff. Someday it might be a car oncoming traffic. Someday it might be, you know, something more serious. So it's not about stopping and, you know, sniffing and backing up the pressure. Sometimes it's like, man, we got to get from point A to point B. You don't have time to worry about that tarp, or you don't have time to worry about that. I'm aware that it's there, but my feel and my focus is taking you over there. So that, if that piece right there can kind of give you an idea, you know, I can't see what it is that you're doing, but almost every single time when I hear these problems and people come to clinics and they have their horse, people go around with the, you know, what I call the soggy rope syndrome. There's no feel on the rope. There's no, you know, horses are moving more from the rhythmic pressure than the steady pressure. I talk about it from the time clinic start to the time clinic finish. And it doesn't matter what stage people are at. If they're having trouble with their horse, it's usually into that piece. It's a huge misunderstanding of this. You know, it's not that we don't have light hands, but I want to have what was described to me by one of my teachers, I want to have iron hands in velvet gloves. So think about that when you're in those situations. Hopefully this gives you some ideas to kind of self-evaluate and make some adjustments on your end with your horse. But I've seen it change the horse's, I don't want to say attitude or demeanor or anything, but it gives that horse direction when they become confused. Because our communication, shoot, when everything's rainbows and butterflies, you know, that's great. You can go along and, you know, off you ride happily in the sunset. What we're preparing for is when things fall apart, when conditions change, when situations change. Can you hold, you know, still hold a conversation with your horse? And, of course, disengaging the hindquarters takes the power away. It sounds like, you know, you already understand that. But changing the horse's mental connection to focus more on you, regardless of what's going on around you, you know, is our ongoing challenge, and it's something you need to be prepared for. Not that the horse is never going to spook, it's that you're going to respond appropriately when, not if, but when they do. So hopefully that'll help you with your horse. Just those, keep those things in mind and really think about, am I putting a real feel for my horse to follow? That almost every single time is the culprit. It's, we inadvertently are reinforcing the fear behavior by backing off, soothing them, taking a minute to sniff at all those things. The horse, in their mind, they're going, well, that's not what a lead horse would do, so therefore you're not in the leadership position. So hopefully that'll help you with your horse.
Okay. And Karen, there's another question that kind of ties in with this, and it's from Karen Gray. And let's see if there's anything you want to add to this topic. She said she spoke with you in Colorado at the Ag Expo, and to kind of jog your memory, you used her guns for trying out shooting. And mm-hmm. It's about her horse being spooky with the tarps and et cetera. She's still mm-hmm. having a lot of issues with the horse being scared of so many things on the ground. If something moves from one spot to another, it's just a huge ordeal. And she's just at a loss what to do to get him over that. Is there anything, since you've seen her in this particular situation, that you'd want to add to that?
Yeah, you know, what I do, and I don't quite remember, you know, but I would start with, I would get a combination of education and tools. I'd go online, I'd order the tools for effective communication, because that can be what's holding you up. Every weekend, I'll change horses out to a different set of tools. That makes a huge difference. And then getting the videos and really studying those DVDs and watching them over and over and over. And again, you know, using that real feel, understanding the difference between steady pressure versus rhythmic pressure, and really take this approach to heart. You know, it's funny because, you know, it's difficult sometimes to describe this approach with horses, but basically what we're doing is we're not training the horses. We're teaching ourselves how to be able to hold a conversation with a horse. That's a conversation of body language, of posture, of feel, of release. You know, pressure isn't punishment, but communication. And I don't know how else to tell people. Like I've said, oh, yeah, you know, everything's good except when I ride my horse, you know, in the parades, you know, and it's kind of like, well, you know, do you have the videos? Do you have the tools? Do you have? And then we're like, well, no, I don't have any trouble, except when I'm in the parade. So I don't know how else to help people develop their skill with their feel and their timing and their balance and all of those things, other than taking them from step one to step two to step three and all those things. So because you can find the holes. Now, if everything's good, I've had people say, man, everything's good. I can ride this horse through the mountains and take them out every weekend or every other day. I mean, I see people ride horses, you know, off into you know, rugged country, and that horse knows what he knows and all that kind of thing. But then the horse sees a soccer ball and just about bucks him off. I've seen that. So, you know, people say, oh, well, now that becomes the first thing on the list. Don't have any soccer balls around, you know. So we tend to, you know, humans and horses, we tend to gravitate and do what's familiar with us. What's important to do, in my opinion, with horses is to develop our skill of communication under every condition and try to find things that you know, the horse and we are not familiar with and become comfortable with it. To me, that's an enriching element in horsemanship and in life in general. We get stuck in a rut, and, you know, the description, the difference between a rut and a grave is the dimensions. That's the only difference between the two. So take that to heart. Get the tools. Get the education. I have a clinic coming up in Durango, and Durango is pretty close there, and I can give you hands-on help as well. But I have not seen a horse. I was asked this last weekend finished a clinic in Snowmass, Colorado, at Moon Run Ranch. And I was asked this by several people, well, you know, Karen, is there a different way, you know, because I talk about leadership and helping us kind of step up and become comfortable. And there were several people who were like, well, I don't know about the leadership thing. I just want him to behave right. You know, is there some other way? And I go, you know, I don't know of any. And, you know, I haven't handled really that many horses in my career, probably only several thousand. That's not that many relative, you know, to other people. But I just don't know of another way to help people and horses understand each other. And here's a piece that it has really hit me strongly recently, because a lot of people talk about resistance and opposition reflex and all kinds of terms like that. You know what? I've realized it's none of that. It's none of that. When a horse demonstrates a behavior that you're not looking for, it's simply because they're confused, period. It's not resistance. It's not, they don't want to do the wrong thing. They want to do the right thing. And oftentimes horses want to do the right thing so bad that they can't help but do the wrong thing because they're trying to do something. They're trying to figure us out. So all I can really do is lay out a pathway for people to develop their skills to become more clear to the horse. But if you can think about things a little bit differently, I heard a wonderful quote out of Wayne Dyer's book the other day. When you decide to look at things differently, the things that you're looking at become different. When you change the way you look at things, the things you're looking at change. So if you look at behavior that you don't want as confusion on the horse's end, then it gives us the opportunity to go, okay, what am I doing? Am I not giving enough feel? Am I too much? Is it abrupt? Is it, you know, it's confusing in some way. Is the timing of my release late? You know, where's the release and the comfort? You know, what behavior am I experiencing when I release the pressure to the horse? All those things, you know, tie into this thing called muscle memory. And when you learn any kind of skill that takes a physical act, whether it's driving a vehicle or riding a bicycle or playing tennis or playing golf, you know, quilting, you know, any of those things that take a physical act, there's a period of time that you take, you know, to develop that feel to be able to be effective with it. Now, here's the thing. You have horses. Oftentimes you have horses that are confused. And so now we're learning this new muscle memory on horses that go, even if you do get it right, they kind of go, I still don't know what you're talking about. So sometimes trusting yourself in your techniques is another opportunity as well. Because as women, and this kind of goes back to why it's horsemanship for women, a lot of times what we do is we approach the horse with something, a technique or a tool or something unfamiliar to them. And the horse has a reaction. Their head goes up. They become frightened. Our natural thing that goes on in our mind is we think, oh, I must be doing it wrong, and we back off. And because horses learn through release or the removal of the stimuli, whatever it is, we think, oh, I did it wrong, and the horse says, no, you did it perfectly. In fact, why don't you just start crying and go back in the house and watch another video? So, you know, there's so many factors that are contributing to our effectiveness with the horses. And, you know, it's either our tools, our approach, you know, or the horse's experience. There's lots of different factors to do that. And that's why I recommend to people just start at you know, square one. The wonderful saying is get square one right and take it with you. But if square one isn't right, I did a trailer loading with a horse with a gal who said, oh, I did all those things. Well, I got to the trailer and I went, man, there is a lot of stuff here going on. I went back to square one, just killing ants, and this horse was absolutely levitating with me, just swinging the stick and string around him. Now, I'm over at the trailer using my tools for communication, but that horse is having a reaction from fear rather than a response with respect, because I hadn't taken the time, the time had not been taken to truly desensitize this horse to the level of intensity that horse needed. And every horse is an individual. So again, in this early stage, you know, until you've gone through this approach with probably, you know, 5 to 10 horses, it's really about the human learning the all of these approaches. You know, we're not really training the horses. We're having our horses become our feedback mechanism to develop our skills. Because this is the thing, you know, the short answer. I walk up to people that are having trouble at a clinic, and I can take the horse from them, and the horse says, "Oh, you bet, I know what you mean, and here we go." And then I hand the horse back to them, and it falls apart. And I can take it from them again, and off it goes, and hand it back to them again. So it's a little bit like me handing my guitar to my friend Eli, who's you know, a developing guitar player. He plays guitar all the time. This guitar I've owned all this time, my guitar likes him better because when he plays my guitar, I just look at it and go, I had no idea that guitar sounded so good, because my guitar is simply a reflection of my current skill and ability. And the only way to get better at a guitar or a horse is simply to just keep fiddling around with it. Eli's so much better than I am skill-wise with the guitar because he spends, you know, so much more time with it than I do. So that's, again, a long answer for a short question, but hopefully that philosophy and that approach will make a difference for you.
You know, Karen, you talk about the girl that's gone to 8 of your clinics, and, you know, if you had said that to me a couple years ago, I thought, what in the world could you possibly learn going 8 different times, you know? And I've been to several, and when you're here in Indiana, that muscle memory is so important. And if you recall, we worked with the Makati Rain, and we kind of discussed how that was going to all work, and, you know, you showed me how to get off on the left side, and I said, well, you know, what if I need to get off on the right side? What am I going to do with all that mess? And, you know, we walked through that, got the muscle memory. I had to use that last weekend, and I had to get off on the right, had to get off pretty quick, and that muscle memory came into play. I did it, didn't even think about what it needed to have happen. It was there. It was in place when I needed it, and I really appreciate that. And I'm thinking, you know, yeah, I could go to that 8th clinic, and because I'm going to be picking up something else that I need to know. And you get those little pieces when you need them. Sometimes you get them when you don't even realize you do need them. You don't know that you know it, or don't know it until you do know it. So, or however you say that little
thing. and this is the thing that, you know, at every clinic, you know, there, you know, people, I know life happens. You know, I understand that. But I said to my husband the other day, I looked at him, I said, you know, because we were talking about people really wanted to come but couldn't, you know, for whatever reason, and I certainly understand, but it's funny, all of a sudden it struck me. I said to Mark, I said, Mark, all these years, you know, we've been pursuing knowledge and going to clinics. I said, have we ever not gone to one? And he thought about it. I said, for any reason, he thought and thought and thought, and he goes, nope, never. So, but, you know, that's, and I wouldn't say that, you know, originally I went to it to one day become, you know, an educator myself. It was my desire and my pursuit of knowledge, because the better I got, the more fun it was, the more confident I felt, the more my horses looked at me and said, oh boy, instead of oh no, and I just became more prepared for the situations. Now, you know, I don't know, you know, my young friend Stephanie, you know, I don't know where she'll take this, you know, but she's enjoying the process. She's, you know, just doing absolutely amazing things with horses. And I'm so excited for it because, you know, I always feel like, you know, if I can pass on this knowledge, that it will go from generation to generation, because, you know, it's a real shame when a true horseman passes on and I think of how much knowledge that they took to the grave with them. You know, it's a shame that, you know, now we've got to, you know, figure it out all over again. So, you know, that's really the commitment of every educator I've met and encountered, is to pass this knowledge on you know, for generations to come. Our children and our grandchildren and their children and grandchildren should not have to learn these things the way we have. You know, it should be just, it can be just very simply explained in concepts and philosophy so people understand how the horse is processing information and how we can adjust our approach for more clarity of communication for them.
Okay. Well, we probably ought to move on to the next question here. So, Karen, this one's on developing leadership, and this is from Nicole. And it ties a little bit into the first couple questions, but it kind of goes into that puppy dog kind of thing. It says, I have almost a six-year-old quarter horse mare, and I got her about a year ago from a local stables. She is sweet and willing most of the time and has only been ridden by me. I have worked with a trainer off and on and watched tons of DVDs on horse training. Yours seems to be the one that makes the most sense to me. However, I'm unsure about what to teach her to yield to my commands while I'm on her back. You see, Kelly and I have a beautiful relationship. I scratch her belly, clean the rocks out of off her feet, give her hay and treats, and in return she lets me get on her back and she takes me off into the sunset. Key word here is she takes me. That's about what she's willing to do. I can't tell her where I want to go. I can't tell her much of anything without getting her offended and refusing to go. On the ground, I have no problem getting her respect. When she gives me an attitude, I just step up the pressure or give her that border look, collie look, and then she thinks about it and does the right thing. When I get on her back, all things change, and I'm not sure how to approach this issue. In my heart, I think, well, maybe it's just rude to make me haul her around and tell her what to do at the same time. Maybe I should just be happy with her being willing, what she's willing to give. I guess the main thing I want to ask is how do you get your horse to be willing to do what you say but still love you and want to be around you?
Hmm. Well, you know, that's an interesting kind of a, you know, partly philosophical, partly technique, you know, kind of a question. You know, to me, I don't tell my horses what to do. I ask them. I invite them. They have full choice. They can choose to you know, follow the comfort, or they can choose to run into the pressure. And, you know, my approach is not unlike what another horse would do. And it's interesting. You know, I've had a bit of a break with a, you know, a bit of a health problem here in recent, you know, past couple of months, and I'm just getting back, you know, with my two horses. And it's really cute because, you know, they've been turned out in pasture while I'm, you know, recuperating. And they're, I kind of describe it, they've gone feral, you know. And it isn't that they've gone feral. They've just kind of gone, you know, there's an absence of leadership from the humans. Not that there was any bad handling or anything like that. But they were making the decisions, and there was no response. And so when I got back with them, they said, oh, hey, Karen, yeah, listen. We have a new program. We walk faster than you when you're leading us, and we walk up and we put our nose on you, and, you know, we might even, you know, look for treats or, you know, whatever. You know, they were just used to making the decisions. And so when I stepped back into that role, I said, hey, guys, good to see you too. You know, and it's a little bit like, you know, the kids come home from grandma's. They've been at grandma's for the weekend, and, you know, grandparents say that what grandkids are for is to spoil them, you know, and send them back home. It's kind of the ultimate payback, I think, for raising us. So they come back from grandma's house, and, you know, how do you, you know, shape that behavior in such a way? Not so that the kids are resentful of you, but that they understand there's certain expectations in the household with our routine and, you know, the things that we have to get done. It doesn't mean that it's all militant, but it means that there's an expectation of behavior. So you may have to reshape that, you know, behavior, you know, making those adjustments. But I got back with my horses today, and I went out there considering that they've, you know, had a couple of months off. I interacted with them. I did this. I did that. And, you know, they were right where I left them. Now, they're not in condition. I took that in consideration. I didn't ask them to do things physically to the extent that I had back when they were more fit. I made that adjustment for their physiology, but mentally, emotionally, everything is really still right there. So, you know, if you can kind of look at things that way, that you're not demanding anything of the horse, you're just causing the right thing to be easy, the wrong thing to be uncomfortable, and then allowing the horse to find the comfort. To me, that's just being able to hold a conversation with a horse. It's not demanding. It's not any of those things, you know, and that's basically what we're talking about. Horses are good. You know, horses are like teenagers. They're great until you ask them to do something they don't want to do. Then leadership steps in. But the horse or the teenager's response today is in relation to all the little things. You know, I'll give you just a simple example. Humans have a pattern. When we open the gate, we're leading the horse. We open the gate, we go through. And oftentimes when I'll watch people, they'll go up to a gate, they'll open it, the horse starts walking through because the horse says, you always walk through the gate. Why would I stop and wait? We have a pattern, the gate's open. Open gate means go through, okay? Now, people, you know, stop to chain the gate or they drop the chain or they do something. That pattern becomes a problem when you need that horse to not make the assumption to go through that gate in that moment. And so people, most of the time, it's not a problem, and we're not even aware that we're doing that. We're doing what the horse is deciding to do. But that little piece right there, when the horse makes the decision, because we have the pattern, there's a lack of response on our part, we open the gate, the horse goes through, and we go, well, I was going to go through anyway. He went ahead of me, but, you know, what's the big deal? Well, now you want to do something on the horse's back and go in a direction the horse doesn't want to go. And the horse says, but you're not the leader at the gate. Why would you be the leader out here? See? So leadership is a full-time job, and I like to compare it to things like parenting. You can't just say, oh, you kids, you know, I'm not going to parent you right now. I'm tired. You know, it's an awareness, and we have the opportunity to shape behavior in every moment. And you notice, you know, with kids, they'll bug you when you're on the phone. And the reason they do that is because you're at a disadvantage. So they come in and they do just enough to try to, you know, this kind of thing. But if mom would just go, you know, Susan, can I call you right back? Hang up, and now don't get off the phone and go bake them cookies. You get off the phone and cause the wrong thing to be difficult. To say, oh, gee, you needed to pester me on the phone. I guess you need to clean the bathroom. And I mean they go and clean the bathroom, not I threaten to have you go clean the bathroom. You need to go clean the bathroom. And I'll tell you what, that'd be the last time that child would pester you when you're on the phone. But usually we don't. We go, we're trying to hold the conversation, and they're asking for the car keys. That when you're at a disadvantage and it's easier, you don't want to interrupt your conversation or be rude to Susan, so you give them the car keys. You're at a disadvantage. And this is what horses do all the time. They check you out all the time, all the time, all the time, or, I don't want to say signs of weakness, but signs of disadvantage. And if you watch horses in the pasture, they are checking each other out all the time. And it takes just one little instant where that horse checks them out and the other horse, what was formerly the lead horse, backs off or, you know, gives way or whatever. And all of a sudden, in that fast, in the snap of a finger, the role of the leadership position can change. And that's what we're looking for. When you go out and you're on your horse's back and you're asking her to, usually at the beginning of the ride, usually we go away from the barn, okay, you're using your leg, and I'm assuming if you're watching my DVDs, you've got the cornerstone for communication, riding from the ground, riding from above. That's the first set, the basic, you know, on the ground and riding information. Watch it in that order, 1, 2, and 3. But the riding from above talks about how you use your leg. And so you want your horse to ride off in sunset, you know, away from the barn, and the horse, say, wants to turn towards the barn. You have pressure on the horse on the side that you want him to turn, just like you do on the ground. When the horse moves in the direction you want him to go, release the pressure. And if the horse goes too far and swings around, goes the other way, the pressure jumps to the other side of the horse. And then the moment the horse turns in the direction you want him to go, there's a release of pressure. So it's those basic concepts and principles that pretty soon starts teaching the horse that, you know, when you follow the comfort, you know, that's your choice. And I'm not telling them to do it, but I'm causing the pressure to be there in the direction I don't want them to go and the release of pressure in the direction I do want them to go. That's our, very simply put, our form of communication. The other thing that happens with horses is, you know, there's the topic of the horse is barn sour. And I differ with that terminology because they're not sour on the barn. They're sweet on the barn. They're sour on what you want them to go do. So So how do you change a horse's mind about what it is that you want him to do? And I've taken horses that are pretty darn extreme. Several horses have been, the people don't know what to do, and they let them run home. I mean, to that extreme, the horse runs home or accelerates home all the time, drags all the way out on the ride, and turns around, and man takes off for home. So, you know, you can do little things like riding out, riding back, riding out a little further, riding back, riding out a short distance, riding back. You know, kind of forget about what your goal is to go on this big, nice, big loop. That might be your ultimate goal. But how do you break it down to where the horse wants to go where you want to go rather than just going, hey, I don't want to get in a fight, so we'll do what you want to do. So you can do little things. You know, I ask people if they think I let my horse eat on the trail. And people always go, no, that's a bad thing to do. And I go, well, not if it's my decision, not if it's my idea. But I have a communication. I reach forward and put pressure on either side of my horse's mane with my hand, and I ask him to lower his head and eat. And then when I want him to quit, I ask him not to eat. So, you know, but I have that level of communication with my horse. So I can take a horse that has trouble and say I want him to go, you know, down the road, okay? I might go down the road and have him eat grass. And then when he wants to come home, I might come back and do the more physically demanding activities. Ride him around the arena, ride him, ride him out, and go let him eat grass. Pretty soon your horse will start jigging on the trail to get down the trail and then start dragging their feet home. So, you know, if this can give you the idea of how do you change the horse's mind about what it is that you're asking them to do, it's always finding that what will click mentally for that individual horse in that moment. So hopefully that'll help you kind of get some ideas and again, keep practicing your skill set, because it's not the horse, it's your current ability to communicate what it is that you want from the horse. And if you have a hesitation, you know, what it sounds like to me is you have a hesitation of, man, I don't want to go there. I don't want any trouble with her. She's sweet. She's kind. We have no problems. I feed her treats. I pick out her feed. You know, why would I want to ruin that? You don't ruin that. You just are going through a little bit of confusion where you're inviting that horse to surrender to your role in a leadership position. But if you're not going to make the decisions, the horse will sure step up and make those decisions for you. And if that's okay, believe me, I see it all the time. Kids' horses are a classic example. You know, the kids really don't ask that horse to do, you know, they like bouncing around. They have a good time. The pony doesn't want to do too much, but you know, I can take a kid's horse and start asking that horse to do different things, and then horse just goes, you know, I don't think you know my program, Karen. I have a pretty strict program, and this is what I do. And I go, well, I can respect that. I understand, and you're good at that. But how about if we do something a little bit different? That's where your skill of communication really comes in. So, you know, keep watching those DVDs. Make sure you have tools that are designed for effective communication, and I think that'll make a big difference for you.
Okay. All right. Well, great, Karen. I'm going to go ahead and move on here. We're getting close to running out of time already, so can you believe it?
We're going to have to start going to 2 hours.
I know. Well, you know how we talk. It may have to go to three.
Maybe.
So, yeah. So this one is from Mary, and she says she's planning on auditing your clinic at Eagle Bear Ranch. She mm-hmm. lives in California, and she doesn't have a trailer, so she's not going to be able to bring her mare. But she does have a question that we were going to discuss as a topic a few months back, and we didn't get to it. And she's wanting to know, can you discuss and give some tips on how to stay in gate? And once you're in that gate, how to keep that without it transitioning back down?
Okay. Again, it is the release of pressure. So when I ask my horse to go, and this is on the Riding From Above DVD, when I ask for the transition up, as soon as my horse begins to accelerate, my pressure doesn't go to nothing, because if my energy was nothing, that would become an indication to stop, okay? So my energy matches the gait that I'm looking for. So let's take walk to trot. I'm going along at a walk. I want my horse to do an upward transition. So I activate my body. I put more energy into my body, because this is called riding, not sitting, but riding. Riding is an active thing with the molecules in your body. So I'm going to activate the molecules in my body. I'm going to kind of put a squeeze on my thighs, turn my heels out, and I'm doing this all smoothly and gradually, I may get to a point where I have my toes out and I pick up my horse with my heels. Now, if I have my heels on and my horse still doesn't transition up, rather than a lot of people get the urge to start kicking there, but if you think of steady pressure to the horse, if we kick, we're going go, don't, go, don't, go, don't, go, don't. Now, lots of horses, you know, they'll feel the kicking and they go, okay, I know how to get them to quit kicking. I transition up. So they figure it out. You know, don't get me wrong. They do figure it out. But when you start using your legs for communication, that kicking motion gets in the way. So rather than kicking, when you squeeze and pick them up with your heels, take a little piece of rope, the tail of your Mercardi rein, or carry a little bit of rope with you, and just rhythmically spank yourself. Just run it across your back rhythmically, side to side, so it's touching your back. And then let, if the horse still doesn't transition, then let that get longer and let it touch the sides of their hips. Now, this is assuming that you've done all your stuff on the ground first, because you don't want to come back. I've seen people come back and go, well, you know, yee-haw, whack them on the hindquarters and off we go. And it's not that. It's a sequence. Horses learn in sequences. So you activate your body. You keep that active. The horse still doesn't transition. You start squeezing with your thighs, turn your toes out, pick them up with your heels, start spanking yourself, spank the hip. The instant they go forwards at whatever stage in the sequence, the instant you get an upward transition, take that pressure away. Okay? Now, but now you're in a trot motion. You know, you're not just sitting there like a sack of potatoes. Your body's active, but all the pressure, your legs release, your swinging of your the tail of your rope stops, all those things, and you're going along at a trot. Now, as long as the horse is trotting, leave them alone. I mean, no legs, no nothing. Don't keep pedaling them. Leave them alone. And if they want to transition down to a walk, good, because then you get to offer the sequence again. Horses are very good at getting us to keep pedaling them. And what we need to do is to trust the horse that they'll respond by simply offering the sequence again each time they transition down to a walk. So, again, we're causing the horse to make the decision to stay in the trotting gait or in the gait that we put them in. So my expectation of a horse is keep doing what you're doing until I ask you to do something else. So, but I have to wait till they decide to do something else to offer that sequence again. So it's the same thing on the ground when you're asking a horse to circle around you. If you ask the horse to go from a walk to a trot on the circle, when they're going at the circle, leave them alone. And this is a little pet peeve of mine. People are being taught to kind of walk forwards in a little circle and keep the stick kind of rolling at them to keep them going, keep them going, keep them going. That to me, it's insulting to the horse that the horse isn't intelligent enough that they can make the decision to stay in gait without us involved. When that horse is trotting, whether it's on the ground or on the horse's back, I leave them alone. That's their job. It's not my job to keep them going. So until I ask them to do something different, either transition up or transition down from there. So allowing that horse to make that decision and not get caught up in the habit, it's a really strong one. I did it for a long time. I didn't even realize I was doing it, that I could feel my horse wanting to transition down, and I wouldn't let him. I'd kind of keep him going, and I realized it'd just be exhausting to keep him going. But allow them to break gait, offer that sequence again, and pretty soon the horse starts saying, well, my comfort right now is in this gait. I'm going to decide to stay in this gait. And that's a big difference. It's a big difference between me pedaling the horse and then allowing the horse to find the comfort in that gait. That's where your comfort is. I'll leave you alone. I'll keep my end of the bargain as long as you keep your end of the bargain. It's a discussion. You know, not a negotiation so much as it's simply a discussion and a communication, clear communication of your expectations. And not just through the pressure to do the upward transition, but the release of that pressure and the trust that you'll leave them alone as long as they're doing what it is that you ask them to do. So that's another hard thing for women to do. We're helpaholics, you know, and what we tend to do is, you know, it's like we ask our honey to mow the lawn and then walking next to him going, keep mowing, keep mowing, keep mowing, you missed a spot. You know, horses are a lot like husbands. When they're doing something for you, leave them alone. Resist the urge to help them.
So
these are a lot of the things that we cover at the clinic, and you'll see that when you come to the clinic. Something I will mention, a lot of people when they come and they audit and they observe, every single one of them wishes that they'd brought a horse. And I know you don't have a trailer and it's, you know, it's difficult for you to bring your own horse. You may want to consider, you know, looking at that again. Almost every time the woman this weekend came up to me and said, I wish I'd brought my horse, figured out a way to bring my horse, or arranged to use a horse there, that that might be a possibility as well. Auditing, you can learn a lot by watching. Don't get me wrong. If you can't bring your horse and you want to come and audit, you can learn a lot by watching. But every single person wishes that they were in there, you know, actually practicing and getting the hands-on help, because it's the opportunity that you have to be there with a horse with, under my auspicion and my feedback to tell you what and help you with your muscle memory, you know, while you're there, rather than going home and going, okay, I hope I remember this whole thing. So when you take it home in your feel, you have a more lasting, a more depth of understanding with it. So just a couple little comments there. But I look forward to meeting you there in Sisters, Oregon. Looking, that's one of my favorite. I have lots of favorite places I teach, but Sisters, Oregon is a pretty special place. Eagle Bear Ranch and TK, the owner of that, it's really a retreat. It really is an amazing place for horses and people, so I'm looking forward to it.
Well, Karen, we've got one last question here, and it kind of ties into this writing from above, and it's from Donna, and she participated in your three-day clinic out in Connecticut, and she has been playing with her horse, Ryan, every day, and she's made great progress, and she's able to catch him within 5 minutes and be seeing that he's really respecting her more. She's been watching the Writing from the Ground DVD and also trying to put those exercises into practice. Her question is, how will she know when it's time to move on to the riding above? Her and her horse, they've not ridden for 5 years, and she still has that fear, and she's hoping next year she'll be considered the most improved person for the next year's clinic, so she's planning on coming out again. And when will she know when she's ready?
After a professional has put in the first rides on that horse. That to me, when a horse is not ridden for that amount of time, that horse is a colt, in my mind. So do not put your, unless you're a professional and you have your precious seat on the back of colts every day, I would not put your precious self up on the back of a horse that is a restart. This is a restart. So in Connecticut, I don't know, Donna, if you'll, or if you, Melinda, if you can forward Donna's email, I will try to connect her with somebody in that area that I personally know and can get to her and give her and her horse the time that they need to restart it. Now, the more time that you spend on the ground, Donna, with your horse and get that foundation really solid, the more homework you'll have, you know, for the horse, so that the person that when they go to ride it, they all those things will be in place for them. But to me, I wouldn't put my precious self on the back of a horse that hasn't been ridden for 5 years. That is a colt. They've gone feral. Okay. So you know, and I'll do my best to get you connected with somebody as close as possible to you. And I'm sure that there's good people around there. I just may not know them. And it'd be really unfortunate to get connected with somebody that's not in alignment with this approach and take all the trust and the leadership and everything that you've established and kind of take it south, because restarting a horse is different than a colt. And I know people who are really, really good colt starters, and they will not take an aged horse anymore or a horse that's a restart, because there's too many patterns of behavior that, you know, most of the time that we take during the clinics is not from the start. It's to overlay the old patterns, you know, the horse. It's not that age has anything to do with it. It's the amount of time those horses have been in those patterns of behavior. So a lot of time what I'm doing at clinics is not just the teaching stage. A teaching stage would be, in fact, Stephanie here who brought a young Mustang that she's had only for 20 days. It's a yearling. And I'll tell you what, she's like, you know, other than not riding the horse, you know, everything on the ground, she's the star of the show. And here she has a horse that's only been out of the wild for 20 days. But Stephanie's been to 8 clinics and has handled, you know, multiple horses. And she's out there every day, all day long, you know, with her horse. So the conditions are different. So Stephanie started, you know, really with me. She had some information with horses, but she started with this approach. The horse is starting with this approach. You know, and it actually goes much faster than the horse that has patterns of behavior, that they've been living in other patterns of behavior for a longer period of time. So get that foundation really, really solid. I'll connect you with somebody that I can personally recommend in that area. If it's not somebody I know directly, it'll be somebody that I respect very highly that knows somebody in that area, and that'll be in alignment with this approach, and we'll get the horse started right for you. So because you're not in a position with your experience level and your background and everything, you know, to do that. That requires a very high level of skill to do that successfully with a horse like that. So, and it may just, she may just ride off happily in the sunset, you know, but I'd rather find that out, or it may not be. And you don't really know until you're on the back of that horse really how, what patterns of behavior that they're going to demonstrate. Don't put yourself at risk, not for a horse. And nobody loves horses more than me, but the truth of the matter is you can get another horse. You cannot get another you. You're too precious to risk that. And, man, I just tell people that. Now, if you want to go do that, if you think, oh, that Karen Scholl, she doesn't know me and my horse, we're, you know, rainbows and butterflies, you know, people have done that too and proven me wrong. But I'll tell you what, I'm proven more right than wrong on that one. So please take that to heart, and we'll get your horse going in the direction it needs to. So the two of you will ride off happily in the sunset. That is my goal.
And then she can be most improved for next year's clinic, right?
Oh, I'll tell you what. It sounds fantastic already. I'm so tickled, you know, because that's a tough thing. You know, Donna was coming back from a pretty serious injury, and the horse had been turned out for 5 years, and you know, she really wanted this for her and that horse. And I said, you know, if this is what you want, I won't tell you can't do it, but I will tell you that the commitment that you're going to make, if you'll take my recommendation, you will ride off happily in the sunset. And that, and I'm just going to make it really clear right here. My recommendation for everybody is that you never quit learning. You don't get to, you know, a handful of clinics and say, okay, I got it, I'm done, because you're never done. You need to keep putting you and your horse under the auspicion of people more knowledgeable than you that can see the things that you're not even aware of yet. Even though the big stuff is, you know, under your belt, please do not make the assumptions that, you know, everything's all, you know, rainbows and butterflies. It's important. You know, to me, my goal is to be in my 90s and still have horses in my life. It'd be a shame that, you know, and it's not to say something doesn't happen or couldn't happen. I could be killed tomorrow with my own, you know, well-trained Andalusians, you know. That's the reality of it. But I want to minimize that risk to a point so that I live a good, long, healthy, enjoyable in life, enriched by horses, and that I can enrich their lives as well.
Well, Karen, before we close here tonight, I'd like to remind everybody that the camp that we have at Golden Hills out in Raymondville, Missouri, and that's October the 10th through the 16th, and you can go online and sign up for that. We've just got a few spots left there. I'm hoping that Stephanie's coming to that. I'd like to meet her and see see what she's doing. So I encourage her to be there. So I know she's been to several clinics, and hopefully camp will be on her agenda as well. So, Karen, do you have anything you want to close with?
No, I just feel so grateful that I have the opportunity to help people with their horses and have these horses have a better life because of it. They really deserve it. You know, every horse out there, they really deserve for us to make our best effort. And everybody who, you know, logs in and listens to the teleseminars and watches the DVDs and invests in the tools and the time and all that, you know, hopefully I can give you, you know, help you on your journey with horses and make it enjoyable and enriching, you know, for the both of you. And then I, you know, get excited about, you know, where this knowledge is passed on beyond you. you know. So everybody who logs in or listens to this online later on, I just get really excited because the knowledge that's being captured here will live on way beyond us, way beyond all of us listening to it tonight. Somebody 100 years from now is still going to be listening to this. I don't know what kind of iPod they'll have then, but but it's exciting to think that these ideas are being captured and going to be shared for generations to come. And I really appreciate everybody participating in that effort. It's not just me doing that. It's Melinda and Mark and Stephanie's and you and all your horses. It's a collaborative effort. I really appreciate everybody that's helping make this happen.
Okay. Well, Karen, we certainly appreciate all the effort and time that you put out to spend with us to do that. So we really appreciate everybody's questions. We ask that you keep those coming. We'll try to get to them as soon as we can. And please join us next month and get online, sign up for the camp, and like to look forward to meeting you out in October out in Raymondville, Missouri. So, Karen, thanks again. Good night, everybody, and join us again next month.
Thanks, Melinda. Have a good evening.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.